Howdy, neighbors. The music is on and we're off. Look out, Latin quarterbacks. The beat is reached, so toot it root. Now with a one, two.
It's the summer of 43, and the tide of war is finally turning in our favor. In February, the Germans surrendered at Stalingrad. In May, the RAF flew the famous Dambusters raids. And in July, Mussolini was overthrown by his own Grand Council of Fascists. In short, there was at last more good news from the front than bad. Back home, Britain's love affair with all things American was blossoming as hundreds of thousands of GIs flooded into the country. And then there were the radio programs that raised our national spirits and kept industrial production on the up and up. There really weren't that many, but top of the list, of course, was It's That Man Again with Tommy Handley.
There is a lady outside who wants to give you a massage.
A massage? Oh, that's just what I'm... Oh, I want that. I'm beginning to get a bit stout out. Now, send her in, Sosa, will you?
Good morning. Nice day.
Yes.
I've come to give you a...
Yes, I know all about it. Now, I'll just get behind that walking stick and take your things off.
What are you talking about? I've just come to give you
yes,
a...
Yes, I know. Sam, hold my collar. Now, mind this wart on the back of your neck. If you touch it, my socks will fall down.
In November 1942, the BBC's Forces programme broadcast Itmar to the tens of thousands of troops preparing for El Alamein, while all over Britain, huge new factories continued to stockpile material for the push across the Western Desert and the long-awaited Second Front. Factory shows like Workers' Playtime and Music While You Work continued to keep peckers up on the production lines as millions of war workers beavered away to keep the hard-pressed troops supplied.
It gives me very great pleasure to speak to my fellow workers on the occasion of the second anniversary of Workers' Playtime, to express on behalf of the government our gratitude to the men and women of this country for the magnificent response to the call to develop the great war industry.
When it celebrated its anniversary in June 1943, nearly 7,000 factories were taking Music While You Work, which meant a captive audience of 4 million listeners. Meanwhile, Workers' Playtime provided a national stage not only for established comedians like Rob Wilton or Elsie and Doris Waters, but also for the up-and-coming talent who would delight audiences in the peacetime years as well. People like Bill Waddington, who one day in the future would play Percy Sugden in Coronation Street.
It was a great programme. It went all over the place. They were all different people, but there were men and women. It was a mixed audience, so it was very, very good. You could have a lot of good laughs without being rude or anything like that, talking about the war. And I was asked to do one day, and I was given half an hour's notice. Could I get there and do it? And I did. I wrote a script, more or less, put it together as I'm going down in the car and running into place. And I was the top of the bill at that, too, last one on. So they had to wait for me to get there. But I used to get away. I used to pull little old things out of the bag and then talk about them.
Elsie and Doris Waters were perhaps the best-known female comedians of the 1930s and 40s and made many appearances on Workers' Playtime. Playing Cockney gossips Gert and Daisy, the sisterly double act, became such an institution that Lord Haw-Haw was once moved to broadcast from Germany that the good folk of Grimsby should not expect Gert and Daisy to protect them from attacks by the Luftwaffe.
Gert and Daisy!
Hello, girls, how are you? All right? All right. Hello, boys, how are you? All right? That's right. Hello, Gert, how are you?
I know you're all right,
well,
anyway.
Well, Daisy, come here. Let's have a look at you. Is your face dirty or is it my imagination?
Well, my face is clean enough. I don't know what your imagination's like.
Workers' Playtime was so successful that it carried on after the war was won. Writer and comedian Barry Took was one of many who got their big break on the show.
I did one at an electronic factory in Cambridge where I did extremely well. And I did one in a bicycle factory in Nottingham where I didn't get a single laugh. I created a record for Workers' Playtime in that I did a 10-minute act and didn't get a laugh in it. The thing that put me off was I looked down and there's a bloke sitting in the front row of this. It was a canteen, the workers' canteen, you see. And there's this guy in his hat and his overall. He's wearing a hat. And he hadn't got any teeth, and he was eating roast beef and Yorkshire pudding with a spoon. And that was my eye line. And I got fixed on this guy. And his eye was fixed on me, and we neither of us smiled, and neither did anybody else.
But back in 1943, shows as popular as Itmar and Workers' Playtime were mightily thin on the ground. Much of the output was dull, and people grumbled that the BBC was failing to provide enough light entertainment for workers seeking relaxation in the evenings at weekends. BBC historian Sian Nicholas.
The more entertainment, popular entertainment was going out, the more senior management feared that Variety Department was losing its high moral tone. It took a long time for the Variety Department to figure out what actually did seem funny in wartime.
When the nations lose their war sense and the world gets back some whole sense, what a day for celebration that will be.
But BBC bosses, struggling to maintain the quality of their output, were facing one of broadcasting's watershed moments. For years, the corporation had resisted a trend towards what it saw as the Americanization of radio comedy. Slick production values, quick humour, and an emphasis on star quality were characteristic of people like Bob Hope, Jack Benny, and husband and wife team Ben Lyon and B.B. Daniels.
Hi, gang!
Ben Lyon and B.B. Daniels had been Hollywood film stars in the 1920s, and when war broke out, they chose to stay in Britain instead of returning to the United States. It was one of the reasons they became a great favourite with British audiences.
Say, Vic, that's a lovely suit you've got on today.
Like it, Ben? That's nothing. I got 50 suits.
50 suits?
Yeah, all against me.
Well, I happen to know that that suit cost you 20 guineas.
How do you know?
I saw the summons.
Ben, how old are you?
31.
Would you like to be 32?
Yeah.
Shut up.
Oh, now, come on, no.
By the time I registered High Gang, it had been running for quite a time and was enormously popular.
Writer and broadcaster Alan Wicker, then a second lieutenant directing army cameramen during the last years of the war.
It was enormously cheery, and it had echoes of Bob Hope, really. It was that sort of thing. And I always thought the one reason for its tremendous popularity was that we didn't have very many friends then. We were alone fighting Germany and, it appeared, the rest of the world. And the idea that Americans would voluntarily stay here to try and entertain us in our lowest hour, there we felt really obliged to be grateful, and we certainly were.
Comedian Bob Monkhouse.
High Gang was so influenced by the input of American material. American radio had advanced in comedy much more rapidly than British radio comedy. And B.B. and Ben, that's B.B. Daniels and Ben Lyon, in alliance with Vic Oliver, they knew that High Gang would work. They'd already done a similar show on Radio Normandy and Radio Luxembourg. Vic Oliver was dead right for them because he'd lived a great deal of his life in America and he knew their tempo. He knew how to fit in with them. During the war, High Gang, starring Americans, broadcast to you from the heart of London, and it was from the Scala Theatre. They were sharing the Blitz with us. That made them very exciting. And Ben's initial cry to the whole audience, big live audience, telling all the people in Germany that we were feeling good and feeling bright and we weren't frightened of the Blitz. We were right there in London. He'd say, "Hi, gang!" And the whole audience would go, "Hi, Ben!" And we were off. And it was tremendous fun.
Now, listen, you two. I don't like the smell of things around here.
Oh, you're just self-conscious.
So all I have left is two guinea pigs and a baby elephant.
Oh, yes. What did we charge Mr. Lyon for valuing the two guinea pigs?
Our cost was exactly two guineas.
That's right. It works out a guinea a pig.
All right, all right, all right. Here's your two guineas. But what about the baby elephant?
He's in that big crate over there.
Oh, that can't be a real baby elephant.
Well, that didn't sound like a canary, did it?
Listening in Croydon in the fastness of the family air raid shelter was screenwriter Brian Clemens, then aged 10.
It had an attack to it, which the others didn't. It had, and you felt they were speaking absolutely to you. There was that empathy about the whole thing. It was very, very good and funny and fast. It was probably much faster than even Itmar. But it was different. It was a different show, and because of its difference, people either liked it a lot or didn't like it at all. Well, I was one of those who liked it a lot.
I think the American accent of Haigang was part of its popularity, really, because we'd had the Bob Hope show, which was enormously popular and went out on Sunday lunchtime, I remember, and wherever one was, everything stopped for Bob Hope. And this was a sort of an echo of the Bob Hope show, not as American, not as brash, and not as funny. Haigang was a variety show with an American accent, but it was also, I suppose, an American variety show with an English accent.
Haigang starred Ben Lyon, B.B. Daniels and Vic Oliver, a refugee from the Nazi persecution of Austrian Jews, and the programme made its debut in May 1940, at a time when Britain had her back to the wall.
And now, gang, I'm going to bring to the microphone a man who really needs no introduction, and he's not going to get any. Come on, Vic. Where are you?
Thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Mr. Lye. I don't see why you never use my middle name when you introduce me.
Your middle name? Yeah. I never knew you had one. What is it?
Such nerve. My name is Vic Quits Oliver.
Quits? That's rather an unusual name. How'd you get it?
Well, you see, when I was born, my father looked at me, and then he looked at my mother and said, "What do you say? Let's call it Quits."
I'm not surprised. Say, Vic, that's a...
There was growing unease about America's refusal to commit forces to the Allied effort, and when France fell in June of that year, it seemed that we were destined to fight the Nazis alone. For the time being, Britain had to settle for American gags instead of GIs. John Hamilton worked on Haigang as a junior engineer.
They were excellent programs. They were beautifully produced, as we would have expected. From production standards point of view, obviously, they were ahead of us. They were more sophisticated to start with, and far ahead of even Itmar and programmes like that over here. You had to think about them, think about the jokes, whereas the homegrown ones were geared mainly to the war and incidents that were happening and the personalities of the war over here. It was a refreshing thing to hear something different.
Thank you, gang. What do you want, Lyon?
Well, I want to know what you and Sam Brown are arguing about.
Well, it's about our farm. He said that my cow, Gertrude, isn't smart, and I say she is.
Well, what's so smart about your cow?
Well, to begin with, she sleeps on her back.
Sleeps on her back? What for?
Well, so the cream will be on top in the morning.
I don't get it.
Haigang was the most excellent entertainment.
Comedian Cyril Fletcher.
It had three very good stars in it, and the comedy was very high class and continuous, and it was a great success. I don't think its success as a show had anything to do with the fact that gallant Bebe and gallant Ben were entertaining the British public in Britain, in a bombed-out Britain, instead of going to the safety of America. I don't think that entered it at all. I think they listened to the show, and they enjoyed every single joke, and my goodness, they came thick and fast.
How seductive everything American must have seemed, viewed from the grinding greyness of wartime Britain. In Haigang, Ben Lyon and B.B. Daniels came to epitomise glitter and glamour at a time when there was none to be had at home, and which reminded radio audiences of pre-war Hollywood. Arthur Askey's daughter, Anthea, used to listen to Haigang as a little girl.
It was unmissable for me. I just loved it because I think it was the first time I'd ever heard an American accent, and I was gobsmacked by it. It was fast, but I thought it had a lovely flow to it. Now, whether that is American accents, you know, I think Americans do flow their dialogue very, very well. I was just completely fascinated. It had such charm. I thought the pair of them had tremendous charm as against a slightly more brusque delivery that a lot of our comics had. And I thought B.B. Daniels was the most... I just thought she was an angel. Thought she was wonderful. And Ben, so lovely and laid back. We all used to sit and watch the radio, you know. It was hysterical. Everyone sat round it and looked at it like we watch television today. And then in the mind's eye, you had these wonderful pictures of this glamorous woman. And eventually I did get to meet them, and I was so thrilled I practically fainted.
They had these great stars on. They had Tyrone Power, Ronald Reagan. In 1941, they had Hedy Lamarr on it, Cary Grant, Judy Garland. Had Dick Powell, Robert Taylor, big stars. The stunt was, if I only had the chance, and each of them, the visiting stars, had to say what they would do if they had the opportunity. And that was a great basis for doing good sketches.
Well, now, Freddie, now that I've got rid of my stooge, I'd like to ask you, like I'm asking all of our guest stars, what your secret ambition really is.
All right, then, I'll tell you my secret ambition. I'd like more than anything else for some kind fairy to wave a wand and turn me into my old country friend, R. Bill. So that I can retire into the country, grow my own food, and forget all about broadcasting.
Say, Phoebe and Dixon,
yes,
Sam Brown knows some of the boys in the RAF, and he's going to try and get me in.
I don't think they'll take you.
Why?
Well, they won't accept anyone over 75 years old.
Oh, now, that's a nice thing to say.
Bob Block worked as a writer with B.B. Daniels on the post-war series Life with the Lions.
When we finished the script, she would pass copies to her secretaries, various other people, and ask them to tick wherever they thought a laugh would occur. They weren't always accurate, but I suppose she that gave her confidence, you know. I think really the thing was that she didn't have too much confidence in her own judgment. I personally preferred to write down what I thought was funny and then trust to that, whereas Bibi was always fearful that her judgment wasn't right.
The BBC had always rejected the American style of featuring quick-fire raconteurs as radio entertainers. Instead, it had encouraged artists like Tommy Hanley to devise intimate on-air personas designed to resonate with the listening millions for whom the wireless had become part of the furniture. In the words of the veteran announcer Lionel Gamlin, just another pedestal for the aspidistra. And yet the BBC was powerless to resist the influence that High Gang and its counterparts had on British comedy routines. It was the first show to introduce the British public to a new brand of humour, the personal insult.
What's next?
They want to know if Ben has any close relatives, has he?
Yeah, they're all close, but he's the closest.
Now, don't be stupid. They want to know the name of one of my blood relations.
Well, now, I put down none.
But I have blood relations.
You have not. They're all anemic.
What made High Gang achieve its terrific impact, I think, on us all, was this this great energy, this vitality, and the fact that they were insulting one another. We'd never heard insult humour, except if you'd gone to see a Marx Brothers movie and seen Groucho giving Margaret Dumont a hard time. But suddenly, really rude jokes about how old Ben was, and he wasn't very old, but they made out he was, and Vic Oliver's absurd mispronunciation of English words, and Bibi's wonderful... she laughed by sucking inwards. And it was just a lovely laugh. And she was also very sexy.
Here is the news. Messages from Tokyo say that Japan has announced a formal declaration of war against both the United States and Britain.
Eventually, in December 1941, after the attack on Pearl Harbor, the United States declared war on Germany and Japan. Thousands of American GIs began arriving in the UK.
I'm gonna see my baby. I'm gonna see my baby. I'm gonna see my baby when I get home on Victory Day.
Not everyone welcomed their presence. Musician Johnny Roadhouse.
British women used to fancy the American man because it could give them a better time financially, and they used to buy them all the extra things that they hadn't been able to get and bring them over, the silk stockings. They weren't married in those days, were they? The GI comes along, gives us some lovely silk stockings. What would you do, chums?
British servicemen resented the fact that their American counterparts received three times more pay than they did.
Historian Mark Donnelly.
They resented the fact that the Americans had better rations, they had better uniforms, they had better provisions in their PX stores. And as a result of all these things, they tended to be very attractive to British women.
I think probably had a little suspicion of them when they first came over here, but I think perhaps there's a terrific feeling of relief to knowing that they'd actually come over to help us, even though perhaps we didn't always admit it.
A large proportion of the population loved American culture. They loved its vibrancy, they loved its energy, they loved its earthiness. They loved the fast pace of US radio comedy. Against that, Britain's cultural elites tended to see American popular culture in particular as vulgar, as brash, as lacking any moral worth.
In those war years, we were being fed two sorts of comic diet. Either we had the domestic product, or we were listening to what was intended for the American forces. The NBC, ABC were being very generous to us, and CBS, by sending over American shows starring Jack Benny and Bob Hope, Burns and Allen, and they were broadcast on the BBC's Forces program. So we were hearing wonderful broadcasts from terrific shows, very snappy, well done, shows called Command Performance and Mail Call. We were being given a very high standard of entertainment on radio that came from America. Our own shows had to cut the mustard. They had to increase in value or die.
Sweet, sweet, happy troll.
Not all homegrown comedy fell by the wayside under the onslaught of American shows. One British wartime comedy show fixed itself in the public fancy just because, like our own Basil Fawlty, it never mentioned the war at all. Happydrome, it was called, and it turned in some of the biggest audience figures of the war. It was set in a make-believe provincial theatre, owned by one Mr. Lovejoy, with his hapless staff of stage manager Ramsbottom and the dim-witted call boy Enoch. Collectively, we three.
We three, we're not highbrow. Just a set of twerps, maybe.
Now, come on, Ramsbottom, don't you start anything. I've had enough to upset me this last few days.
You certainly have, Governor. Look at that dog that bit you. Was it an accident?
No, Ramsbottom, that dog bit me on purpose.
How did he come to bite you?
He didn't come to bite me, I went to him. They told me he was a lap dog.
Lap dog?
Yes, and when I tried to sit on his lap, he bit me.
Ramsbottom and Enoch and me.
Happydrome was the quintessential end-of-the-pier show, old-fashioned northern humour of the lowest common denominator. Produced by Ernest Longstaff, the show became a happy weekly release from the all-too-real cares and concerns of a nation at war.
Well, I'm glad you didn't quarrel with your neighbours about it, Governor.
No, you have to be a diplomat these days, Ramsbottom.
Tell me, how would you define the difference between a diplomat and a lady?
Well, if a diplomat says yes, he means maybe. If he says maybe, he means no. If he says no, he's no diplomat.
Ah, but what about the lady?
Well, if a lady says no, she means maybe. If she says maybe, she means yes. And if she says yes,
well,
she's no lady.
And it's a very happy programme, and if I can dare to use the word these days, very gay and very, very bright.
Roy Hughes often went to the Happydrome broadcast on a Sunday night in the early years of the war.
It was broadcast from the Grand Theatre in Llandudno, and the only way you could get tickets was to hang around the enormous crews outside the Grand Theatre at about 7:30 on a Sunday evening. And I used to have an awful lot of homework over the weekends, but it was my relief to go out on a Sunday evening about 7:00, having completed my homework, and go off to the Grand Theatre to try and get in the Happydrome.
Happydrome's star was a Manx comic called Harry Corris, whose catchphrase, as the put-on Mr. Lovejoy, "Ee, if ever a man suffered," was one of the few, outside of Itmar, that passed into the language. Harry Corris's son, Vic.
I think they liked it because of the simplicity of the humour. There was no offence, nobody could be hurt by it, nobody could be embarrassed by it. It was just plain, honest-to-goodness, fireside humour. It was corny. And you wouldn't get a laugh out of it if you heard it today, because there was no suggestions, no innuendos. It was straight, honest dialogue. People were they easier to please in those days? They must have been, but it began to fade a bit. Mind you, there was new blood coming up. The humour was fast and furious. I don't think it could compete with it.
And, of course, much of that new blood was American. As the war drew to a close, the special relationship so beloved of Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s was being forged, and not only in the world of politics. Britain and America shared a common language and culture from which sprang a host of comedy classics, magic moments from radio, television and the movies. What was on the wartime wireless made people laugh. It bolstered morale at home and abroad, boosted production and kept the nation in good humour even in its darkest days. Programmes like Itmar, Happydrome and High Gang helped to win the war. There could be no doubt about that. The director, Jonathan Miller.
When you were in a period of bleak austerity and danger and fear and a sense that your back was up against the wall, I should imagine that those memorable moments were cherished. It wasn't a golden age. It was simply what made it possible to go on cheerfully at a time of great danger. It just happened that talent would out.
And what of the BBC? How did Ante rate her performance during the war years? Sean Nicholas again.
I think the BBC rated its wartime success very highly. It was very proud of what it had achieved during the war, very proud of how it had helped maintain public morale, and I think very proud of how it had broadened its appeal during the war in things like comedy. If in the 1930s the BBC had been respected, I mean, it was far more liked now. There was a public warmth towards the BBC by the end of the war. Although that being said, I think there was a feeling among the BBC hierarchy that maybe it had achieved this popularity by compromising its pre-war standards. There were certainly some people in senior management who felt that maybe things had gone a little far and had to be drawn back in the post-war years.
In the end, it wasn't just the stars like Tommy Handley or Ben Lyon, but the millions of ordinary listeners whose laughter cheered those terrible dark days of World War II. For the first time, the BBC united a national audience with laughter, and that was the key to victory. Veteran war correspondent Godfrey Talbot, who had seen battles firsthand and reported too on the triumphs and hardships of the home front, is in no doubt about Ante's performance.
They were the BBC's finest years, not because we were necessarily chosen as the finest people, but because the radio was there and we used it to sustain relief, relaxation, as well as to encourage morale, guts and bravery, both. And the habit of switching on through the radio, which had been part of life itself during the war, didn't suddenly stop. The BBC emerged with honour.
And here we are, several wars later, on the brink of the millennium, and still able to cook and knit and draw while we listen to our friend the radio. Or the wireless. Well, it doesn't have wires anymore, does it? Goodbye.
Being So Cheerful was presented by Bill Tidy. The series was written by Roger Wilkes and produced in Manchester by Libby Cross. Next week, Hugh Dennis presents There's a Funny Thing, a wry glance at one of British comedy's perennial favourites, the summer holiday season.